Welcome to Oncology Today, key presentations on multiple myeloma from the 2022 ASH meeting. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Jeremy Laubach from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. In addition to this audio program, there's also a corresponding video program featuring Dr. Laubach's slide presentation. To begin, I asked him to reflect back on the recent evolution of induction therapy for patients with multiple myeloma.
Well, it's fascinating, of course, to see, you know, how the field has evolved. For me, you know, personally, over the 15 years that I've been a part of this field, as I was entering practice as a myeloma specialist in 2008, we were in a place where we were primarily using doublets. And coming from a place before that where we were, in some instances, using single-agent dex. So for some time, we were using lenalidomide and dexamethasone. For some time, we were using bortezomib and dexamethasone. And then, of course, the development of triplet therapy had a major impact on the field. And I think as a field, we were very fortunate in the sort of 2017, 18, 19 timeframe to have publication of several major phase three trials, which I know you're familiar with. First was the SWOG-077 trial of Len-Dex versus lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone. Showed, you know, significant improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival. Now, of course, we had been using triplets long before that phase three data was available. It was evident to us on the basis of phase two data that the triplet worked better than the doublet in terms of response rates. But of course, we needed that confirmation in phase three trial. And then, of course, in 2019, we had the publication of the MAIA trial, which was lenalidomide dex versus daratumumab, lenalidomide and dexamethasone, another landmark study in the field showing benefit of triplet over doublet therapy. So now I think we stand on very, very solid ground to support these triplet regimens. And as you point out, the question becomes, at this point in time, in 2022, 2023, where do we stand with regard to quads? The Griffin trial, of course, was a high-profile, randomized phase two study, approximately 240 patients. I would say that's been a highly impactful phase two trial. And I think it is tilting our field towards a more widespread usage of quadruplet regimens. I think we have good long-term follow-up from the Griffin trial showing, you know, dramatic improvements in terms of depth of response, including MRD negativity. And we have really nice progression-free survival data as well, you know, after 3 years, which is statistically significant. Also, interestingly, with Griffin, you know, it was demonstrated that these responses continue to deepen over time with the use of a doublet maintenance regimen after transplant, lenalidomide and daratumumab. And this is a similar analysis from Dr. Silberman and colleagues involved in the Griffin study, and similar to the MAIA data. Looking at patient-reported outcomes with regard to symptoms and functionality after initiation of treatment. This was looking at time to first worsening of patient-reported outcomes. So, you know, patients receive therapy, they feel better. When do the benefits begin to wane? And you can see here that with usage of several different metrics or measurements of patient-reported outcome on the left, the various scales that were used, that the incorporation of daratumumab led to prolongation of benefit with regard to functionality. This, I think, brings us back to how duration of response or progression-free survival translates in many instances into improved quality of life. And I think that was certainly true in the Griffin trial, which I was involved with as an investigator, that because of the prolonged duration of response, patients really had improved quality, particularly because Dara-Len is a very well-tolerated long-term maintenance a combination. So I think it's all very compelling data. I think at this point in my practice, I'm using a quad for high-risk patients without question. For standard-risk patients, I'm really reviewing all aspects of their care, discussing the data with them, reviewing, you know, triplet data from SWOG, reviewing quadruplet data. And in some cases, you know, you make those decisions with the patients. And I find that very helpful. Many of the patients have come in having educated themselves about, you know, options and have an opinion. And we discuss that and make a decision together.
Any thoughts about where isatuximab is going to fit in terms of upfront? I see now they have a sub-Q delivery system, so that's really helpful. And in your mind at this point, you know, it kind of reminds me of all the discussions that go on in solid tumors about the PD-1 agents, but can you see any, indirectly looking at these two agents, Dara and Isa, can you see any difference at this point?
The response data is very similar. And I think in terms of tolerability, quite similar. Perhaps the rates of infusion reactions, hypersensitivity, are a little bit lower with IV isatuximab versus IV Dara. But of course, we're not using IV Dara much longer. And we won't be using IV isatuximab once the subcutaneous formulation is available. So it's a good question. It's nice to have, you know, different options. Of course, you know, we've got multiple different proteasome inhibitors, but in contrast to ISA and daratumumab, where the side effect profile is quite similar, that's not the case with the proteasome inhibitors. So, I think it was in the case of the proteasome inhibitor question a bit more straightforward to make clinical decisions about which to use based on comorbidities and other factors that might influence that decision. With isatuximab, I think there's ongoing study. I'm leading a study currently, a phase 2 trial of isatuximab plus lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone in upfront. I can't say too much about it yet because we don't have data, but I think there's certainly interest there.
So I'm curious, have you used the new sub-Q ESA delivery thing? I'm trying to understand how it works. Have you actually used it?
I have not used it yet. So I can't comment on that, but I know that we'll be eager to do so when it becomes available. I was part of the phase 3 trial of daratumumab subcutaneous right. Several years ago, and boy, what an impact that's had.
Absolutely. Another thing I was just curious about, and I think you're going to talk a little bit about it, but just, you know, kind of from a macro point of view in terms of where things are, has been the issue of autologous transplant and the determination trial that your colleague presented. And just kind of curious, you know, how you see that rolling out. I kind of been surprised how pro-transplant people have continued to be in spite of the lack of survival data. Any thoughts about that?
Well, in 2021, 2022, we had two major randomized phase 3 trials published evaluating the role of transplant. One was the Italian Forte trial, and then there was the determination trial, as you mentioned. And both of them show a highly significant progression-free survival advantage, not an overall survival advantage. And I think in our field, that speaks to the fact that we have so many effective available lines of treatment for second, third, and fourth line treatment. And the fact that in both those trials, patients who weren't transplanted as an initial consolidative approach would have had the opportunity to undergo transplant as a second-line treatment, which could also obscure a survival advantage that you might see if no transplant was allowed as next line of treatment, which, of course, would make the study unethical. So, you know, those factors play into it. I think the progression-free survival advantage in determination, for example, was highly significant at 21 months And as we all know, and some of the papers we're going to review in a little bit demonstrate, when patients are in a deep response and it's a durable response, they feel better. So I think it's very clinically relevant data, as you point out, but I think as long as there's such a highly significant progression-free survival advantage, which of course was the primary endpoint of both those trials, it'll continue to gain usage internationally. That being said, I think with the development of the newer immunotherapies, the CAR-T approaches, the bispecific antibodies, as we'll talk about in a little bit, there's going to, you know, continue to be interest in evaluating the long-term role for transplant in our field. But to date, studies have remained positive on transplant.
Yeah, I think maybe actually that may be one of the reasons I hear so many questions from oncologists about that, having seen what's going on in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma as CAR-T sort of is moving in front of transplant. Maybe transplant's going to go away in terms of diffuse large B-cell.
I was going to say one other thing, Neil, and that's, I mentioned before about, you know, the discussions we have with patients. And I think, you know, for me personally, this is what makes being a clinician so enjoyable. You know, it's not a one-size-fits-all cookie-cutter approach to any of this in the clinic. And when I receive a referral from a physician in the community on transplant, I really look forward to those visits. There's so much data to review regarding how transplant's carried out, what the clinical trials have demonstrated, what are the toxicities associated with transplant versus non-transplant related approaches. And it really is, in this context, shared decision-making, right? I think if a patient's responding well to induction therapy, particularly if we're using MRD negativity to guide decision-making, the patients have a lot of options. You know, for example, if they achieve MRD negativity in the context of induction therapy pre-transplant, you know, determination pretty clearly showed that, you know, those patients are going to do well regardless of whether they get a transplant or not. So that's a new tool at our disposal, not so new anymore, but it's a powerful tool at our disposal. And it's one more piece of information that we gather that we can share with patients in making this decision together.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the 21 months and that patients feel better. And I know there are data on patient-reported outcomes from these and other trials. Sometimes I see that and I can identify with it. Sometimes it's kind of hard to interpret that. But I guess if you think about it, the transplant arm, you know, is going to go way down for a few months at least, maybe longer. But then you have this longer tail when they're not relapsing. Maybe, you know, interesting to think about the kind of trying to explain that to a patient and what they get out of it. I guess maybe it's understandable when you think about it. Mm-hmm. But it is a tough trade-off. So one other thing I was just going to ask you about, you mentioned bispecifics and CAR-T. And again, I know you're going to go through a bunch of those data. But just sort of generally, what do you see happening over the next 2 to 3 years? And particularly, how far up do you see these therapies being moved? I know in some situations, you know, it's being looked at upfront, combinations, depending upon risk, et cetera. Where do you think we're going to be in 3 or 4 years?
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, drugs that are, you know, possess potent anti-tumor activity and are well tolerated move up front. And, you know, for me, having been involved in the early development of daratumumab a decade ago, we saw that occur very quickly, you know, thanks to the efforts of patients and their involvement in the trials of the academic centers and other collaborators. I mean, that just moved so fast from, you know, a fourth line treatment to a second line treatment and now, you know, into frontline. So I anticipate that, you know, we're going to see similar interest in evaluating these agents for newly diagnosed therapy. And I look at daratumumab, for example. We had a 35% response rate in patients with 3 prior lines of therapy in the phase 1 trial. As we'll, you know, cover in a bit, teclistamab had a 63% response rate in patients with 6 prior lines of treatment. And talquetamab, you know, the data from Dr. Chari that we'll review, has a 70% response rate. Now, the toxicities are a bit more difficult to manage as far as CRS in the short run. But you get past that first cycle of therapy, and generally speaking, patients do well. I think we really have to, you know, watch the infection signal with these drugs. They are, you know, potent immune drugs. And, you know, that's something that we'll have to watch in the upfront setting, particularly as we put them in combinations. There's a lot to learn, but it's going to be very, very interesting to see how these progress. Our center, like many others, has, you know, great interest not only in treatment of newly diagnosed, but also for high-risk smoldering patients. And my colleague Irene Gobriel here, who leads our Centers for Prevention of Progression, or CPOP, has a CAR-T trial now in smoldering.
Wow.
With Ciltacel, and a teclistamab trial that she's leading with my colleague Omar Nadim. So a lot of interest there, and we'll see, you know, what the data shows.
Wow, that is incredible. I was just flashing on the fact that we did a program last fall with your colleague Betsy O'Donnell. I don't know how you stole her from Mass General, incidentally, but because we worked with her when she was over there. But anyhow, we did this program 2 days after teclistamab was approved. And so, you know, we were all excited talking about it. But I was telling her on the day that it was approved, I was doing a video with, we did this program where I was talking to patients. And I did a video of a patient who'd been on the day that teclistamab was approved, had been on it for a year and a half and doing great. And I've been using that video as an example to demonstrate, you know, the value of clinical trial participation. I think he got it second line too, incidentally. But he was just as happy as can be. But again, you know, he'd already been on it for a year and a half.
Yeah, it's remarkable, and it's one of the most exciting things, as you know, of being in the field of oncology and being involved in the development of new drugs, you know, whether we're directly involved or not. It's just bringing these drugs to the clinic and seeing patients who, you know, just 3 years ago, we would have been, you know, transitioning into discussions of palliative care. And now, you know, we're able to tell them, not only do we have another line of therapy, but there's a pretty darn good chance you're going to respond, and that you may have a very significant response that is durable. And not only that, but there are more effective therapies, whether it's, you know, the cereblon-targeting drugs like iberdomide or mezigdomide, or the newer bispecifics targeting non-BCMA epitopes, or the new CAR-Ts. There's more coming. So it makes it really, I think, gratifying in the clinic to just offer this level of really tangible hope for patients.
All right. Well, with that as a little bit of a background, why don't we have you talk about some of the papers that were presented at the ASH meeting, myeloma?
Okay, fantastic. I'm really thrilled to have a chance to speak about some of the exciting work that was presented at the ASH meeting. And as we often do, I've kind of grouped it the papers in terms of newly diagnosed and relapsed refractory. We'll cover first some of the work that pertains to transplant ineligible patients, and then transplant eligible. And then in the relapsed refractory, we'll be looking at a couple of updates on the IKEMA and IKARIA trials involving isatuximab, looking at MRD assessments in patients undergoing CAR-T. And then there were a number of really interesting data presented on the bispecific antibodies. And we'll finish with a discussion of mezigdomide. So the first was an update from Dr. Kumar on MAIA. Now, MAIA was originally published 4 years ago now, spring of 2019. And then we had an update in 2021. With more mature data, which first showed an overall survival advantage. And now we have this most recent update from ASH with 73 months of follow-up. And as you can see, there's a 35% reduction in risk of death with the use of daratumumab, Lendex versus lenalidomide and dexamethasone. And those curves, you know, appear to continue to separate. So it just highlights again the fact that, you know, this is a really outstanding regimen for patients with newly diagnosed disease who are transplant ineligible. And certainly it can be considered as an option in patients who are transplant eligible, you know, along with the lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dex combination, for which we also have very strong phase 3 data with a survival advantage. That was of note. And this is really not surprising to see. It's been presented before, but it just highlights the fact that the three-drug combination is associated with really robust levels of response, including MRD negativity. You see there 32% versus 11% MRD negative. And with longer follow-up, it's just nice to keep an eye on this issue of sustained MRD negativity. And you can see that the three-drug regimen results in a much higher rate of sustained MRD negativity at both 12 and 18 months. So this was an interesting trial that looked at a subset of patients in the Mayo trial who were deemed to be frail. And they were determined to be frail on the basis of age, comorbidities, and functional status, ECOG performance status. There were a number of interesting facets to this. They looked at improvement in both functionality and symptoms from baseline over time. And you can see here that, as we were discussing before, deeper levels of response result in improvement in symptoms. And myeloma patients often experience significant musculoskeletal pain. In fact, it's one of the most common manners in which patients present with musculoskeletal pain. And it's clear here that the use of the three-drug regimen does a better job of alleviating cancer-related pain. There would be concern in adding a third drug to the treatment of a frail patient that you might induce significant asthenia or fatigue. And so, you know, in the past, you know, that's a patient population where we might have considered a doublet. Even with the improved response, PFS, and overall survival data, if you've got a frail elderly patient, for example, you might consider a doublet in that context. And that's where I think the data on the right side here is very telling, that with the addition of daratumumab, you really didn't see an increased rate of fatigue or asthenia. I think on the whole, patients tolerate this regimen quite well. There was an increased risk of infection, as you know, with the addition of daratumumab, but I think we're mindful of that, and we counsel patients to you know, contact us in the event of infection-related symptoms and proactively initiate anti-infection treatment. This was another interesting trial that was from the IFM group, the IFM 2017-03 trial. This was looking at basically a steroid-sparing version of the Maya regimen. So it's daratumumab and lenalidomide without a significant amount of dex. Now, patients would be receiving some steroid as a pre-medication prior to dexamethasone, but no steroid beyond that. So it's really a steroid-sparing approach, which I think is of great interest, particularly in this particular patient group. So it was daratumumab and lenalidomide versus lenalidomide and dex. And as you can see here, even in the absence of dexamethasone, the superiority of a dara plus len combination persists. And I think this is really interesting data. I think it's in some ways very, quote, real world practice informing data. Because it would leave me as a practitioner with a sense of confidence that for certain patients who perhaps have diabetes, perhaps have issues with agitation or mood changes with steroids, that you could really minimize the amount of steroid you use in the treatment of such patients and still not compromise the effectiveness of the regimen. This was an interesting study that was presented by Dr. Wiesel from the German myeloma study group, targeting a high-risk patient population. So these were patients who had ISS stage 2 or 3 disease. This was before we had the RISS, I think, that this study was designed. So it was ISS stage 2 or 3 patients, along with either deletion 17p, 414, 1416, or amplification of 1q. So these are four different chromosomal abnormalities, which, as you know, are associated with a really highest risk multiple myeloma. And this was a regimen that was a quad. So it's really kind of following up on the experience with Griffin, but with isatuximab rather than daratumumab, and carfilzomib rather than bortezomib. So as you can see here, there's two arms to the trial, and 99 patients enrolled who were transplant eligible, 26 who were transplant ineligible. And I wanted to include this patient disposition here as a slide because I think it's really interesting to see just how challenging this patient population can be to manage. You're giving them perhaps the most intensive quad regimen we could offer in 2022-23, anti-CD38 plus KRD. And they're getting 6 cycles of ESA-KRD, so a hefty amount of induction therapy, followed in the first group by a transplant, followed by post-transplant consolidation with 4 cycles of ESA-KRD, and then long-term maintenance with a 3-drug combination of ESA-KR. In the non-transplant eligible patients, they got 8 cycles of ESA-KRD, followed by a consolidation and the same maintenance. And what you can see here is that even in the context of induction therapy, you've got a number of patients dropping out of the study because they've progressed. And then at each iteration, now this isn't unique to myeloma clinical trials. We see it, but this is a fairly high percentage of patients that even with the most intensive type of induction regimen you could offer them, there's dropout because of progressive disease, just highlighting the fact that this is a very, very challenging patient population to manage, and wonderful that we have regimens of this sort that are going to offer many patients a good shot at achieving response. So the primary endpoint of this trial is MRD negativity after consolidation. And you can see here that among the patients that made it through the end of consolidation, 66 of them were evaluable for MRD negativity or MRD status. And of them, 63 were MRD negative. So on the whole, as is evident based on this data, this is a very, very active treatment combination. It also builds a bit on the experience of the Forte trial that I had mentioned before, which was a KRD induction followed by transplant, and then a randomization to either standard lenalidomide maintenance or lenalidomide plus carfilzomib, and showed benefit to the addition of carfilzomib as maintenance. So I wouldn't say that carfilzomib as maintenance is a standard approach, but certainly if you have a highest risk patient like this, this is, a patient population where you would want to consider at the very least a 2-drug maintenance regimen on the basis of the Forte trial. And for those patients who are 17p deletion, even consider, 3-drug maintenance with an anti-CD38 plus either bortezomib or carfilzomib and lenalidomide. So this was an update of the IKEMA trial by Dr. Martin. The IKEMA trial was a randomized phase 3 comparison of isatuximab plus carfilzomib and dexamethasone versus carfilzomib and dexamethasone. The previously published data from IKEMA showed a highly significant PFS advantage and ultimately led to the approval of isa plus KD. This trial this report is a subset analysis of that study, looking at outcomes in patients who were early relapsers to their previous line of treatment versus late relapsers. And we know that from previously published data that patients who relapse early, for example, following induction therapy in a transplant ineligible patient or following transplant within a year of transplant for a transplant eligible patients, have poor prognosis. And I think the importance of this report from Dr. Martin is to see how does this regimen fare in those patients who are at higher risk based on early relapse. And as you can see here, the ESA-KRD fared quite well. The hazard ratio was a bit higher here in the early relapses, as might be expected, given the prognostic implications of early relapse, but that's a still highly significant outcome. And I think it lends support for the use of ESA plus KD in this context. Dr. Richardson presented a analysis derived from the ICARIA trial, which was another randomized phase 3 trial, which compared isatuximab Pomdex versus standard pomalidomide and dexamethasone. That likewise was a positive trial in favor of isatuximab plus Pomdex with a significant advantage in terms of progression-free survival as well as response rates. Sequencing, as you alluded to earlier, Neil, is a question that we face frequently in clinical practice in multiple myeloma because there are now so many effective lines of treatment. The question becomes, how do you sequence them? This particular analysis was looking at what regimen patients received after either isatuximab plus Pomdex or Pomdex, and evaluating response to next line of treatment. As you can see, this analysis excluded daratumumab as another CD38 targeting therapy, although in a subsequent portion of this report, outcomes among patients treated with Dara as a subsequent line of treatment were also presented. But I sort of chose to focus here on outcomes for regimens that did not include daratumumab, because quite frankly, in clinical practice, it's not so common to follow one CD38 monoclonal antibody therapy with another, at least as the next line of treatment. You might certainly come back to it later, but not as the next line of treatment. And what you can see here is that on the whole, patients who had been treated with Pomdex responded better to next line of therapy, even without daratumumab in the mix, as I mentioned, than those who received ESA plus Pomdex, speaking to the fact that these patients would have progressed and been refractory to not just an IMiD, but also to CD38. So that sort of makes sense. What was interesting, though, is that patients in both arms really didn't respond terribly well to next line of treatment that included another IMiD. Now, again, of course, they're coming off of IMiD therapy here in both arms. So perhaps that's not surprising, but those data are pretty striking. And on the contrary, patients did better in receiving regimens that didn't include an IMiD. So that could have been an alkylating drug, it could have been a proteasome inhibitor, et cetera.
Have we learned much about mechanisms of resistance to anti-CD38 antibodies?
I can't say that we've learned a lot about mechanisms of resistance that are relevant in the clinic. There may be basic science, translational science that I'm not as well versed in or well aware of, but I'm not as familiar with it.
Do you lose CD38?
You do lose CD38. And that's why following one CD38 targeting therapy with another is really the issue of receptor occupancy. If there's no receptors to occupy, the drug's just not going to work. But you do redevelop CD30 expression over time. So the idea of using CD38 targeting therapy again as a later line of treatment certainly makes sense.
That's interesting. Please continue.
Okay, then we're going to turn to two studies that were looking at MRD analysis after CAR T therapy. And I find these studies to be very interesting and clinically relevant, useful, because there's uncertainty in standard of care practice about when to employ MRD analysis following CAR T. Of course, in clinical trials, patients tend to get a baseline MRD assessment, then at 1 month, 6 months, 12 months, 18 months. It's done frequently. And I think these data are able, I think, moving forward to inform our practice. This was a trial that looked at MRD rates or status in the aftermath of IDA-cell therapy. And again, MRD analysis was performed along with serological analysis at multiple time points. And what this study demonstrated is that the MRD status at 1 month after IDA-cell predicted early relapse. And those curves are quite dramatic. They also included in their analysis the standard serological response rates with CR or something less than CR. But it's interesting, the overlap between the blue and yellow curves. There's really no difference there, but patients who don't achieve an MRD negative status within 1 month after transplant really tended to do poorly with IDA-cell therapy. And I think as I look at that data and think about how I'm going to implement that in clinical practice, I will likely begin, certainly following IDA-cell, to make a recommendation to undergo MRD assessment. Because if a patient doesn't achieve MRD negative status on the basis of this data, we really need to begin thinking about next line of treatment.
I was just sort of flashing on bringing in a bispecific at that point. Is that being looked at?
I'm not aware as yet that CAR T followed by bispecific antibody therapy is being looked at in clinical trial, but certainly in clinical practice, yes, you're absolutely right. And I've had numerous instances in recent years of, you know, following CAR T therapy with either belantamab, the antibody drug conjugate, or now with teclistamab. I have less experience with it in standard of care practice with teclistamab only because teclistamab was just approved, but I have multiple instances in my practice of utilizing belantamab following progression after CAR T therapy and, you know, seeing success in that context.
You mentioned the word belantamab. I haven't talked about that in a couple of months. Anything new in terms of getting it back?
The trials are ongoing, and I think the status of belantamab will really be contingent on results of the ongoing phase 3 trials. That's what I would say.
Just out of curiosity, have you had any patients who you felt for sure really did well on a belantamab?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can tell you the experiences of numerous patients who have done well with belantamab. Perhaps most interestingly, Neil, I have a patient who I've been treating for 4 years, has high-risk disease, 17p deleted. He had initial therapy with RVD transplant, relapsed, and I had him on the randomized phase 3 trial of daravenetoclax because he has 1114 translocation along with his 17p. He had a relatively short duration of response, and he received venetoclax as part of that clinical trial participation, and then relapsed. I gave him one more line of therapy, had no response, and I got him to IDA-cell CAR T. He had no response to IDA-cell. He was transplanted in August and was already relapsing in November, December of 2021. And as he relapsed in the late autumn and winter of 2021, early 2022, he developed large plasmacytoma in his abdomen. We radiated it. I had not much else to offer him, and I started belantamab in February of 2022. He is still now, 15 months later, in a complete response. And wow. Because of the eye toxicity, he's receiving the agents, you know, at most every 6 weeks, and in some cases we're delaying 8 weeks, and he's still responding to it, and it's just been beautiful. So he's fortunately been able to transition to the expanded access program, and is doing really well with careful input from our ophthalmology colleagues.
Not that it's typical, but I interviewed a woman who'd been on belantamab for 4 years. And, you know, I mean, it's not, I'm sure the FDA has a lot of challenges, so I'm not going to criticize them, but it is thought provoking. We just were at the Society of Gynecologic Oncology meeting. Your colleague Joyce Liu was in one of our programs, and we presented a patient who had a 7-year response to a PARP inhibitor who in that situation was pulled off the market by the FDA. So I guess anecdotes don't make anything, but I mean, your case is amazing as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think to everybody's credit, you know, there was a lot of effort that went into making the drug available on expanded access. And like I said, we'll see what the ongoing phase three trials show. You know, I know that the company's committed to it. The investigators are committed to continuing these studies until we have further data.
We're seeing so many antibody drug conjugates also in oncology. I'm trying to think, is there any other antibody drug conjugate to BCMA that's been studied?
That's the only one that I'm aware of.
Wow, really amazing. Please continue.
This was another report from Dr. Munshi and colleagues who were looking at MRD status following Cilta-cel, which is, we know, is the second FDA-approved CAR-T product in multiple myeloma. And this really highlighted the impact not of MRD status at a particular time point, but of sustained MRD negativity. And perhaps not surprisingly, patients who had sustained MRD negativity beyond 6 months and even beyond 12 months tended to do very well. So what does this mean in terms of my clinical practice? I am eager to see additional data from this and other studies looking at this issue, but I will probably recommend to patients moving forward that we check MRD status at 1 month post-CAR-T in standard of care practice, and then again at either 6 or 12 months. Of course, doing MRD assessment requires a bone marrow evaluation, so it's asking a lot of patients. I think many patients are interested in knowing what the current status of their response is, and discussing this data with them, we will, you know, likely make a recommendation for that 1 month time point, and then perhaps again at 6 and 12 months.
I was alluding to the CAR-T data in diffuse large B-cell, and one of the things you see there that I'm not sure we've seen in CAR-T with myeloma is a plateau. I don't know whether if you start looking at MRD, you can pull out a group of patients who do have a significant plateau. Do you think there are people being cured of myeloma or really prolonged responses, or is pretty much everybody relapsing?
I wouldn't at this point, because I think the data is still immature, particularly with regard to Cilta-cel, which we know is the more potent of our two approved CAR-Ts. And the data is still, I think, not yet mature enough to comment. I'm reluctant to use the word cure in this disease, but certainly long-term responders is appropriate. First patient that I treated on Ide-cel had a 4-year progression-free interval, and she had had 10 prior lines of therapy. So it's certainly true that, you know, even among very heavily pretreated patients, there are some patients who are quite sensitive to these modalities and have long-term responses.
That's incredible, 4 years. But did that patient progress?
She ultimately progressed, and is now doing well on next line of therapy with isatuximab plus pomalidomide and dexamethasone, and had been, you know, previously treated with Dara, but never received isatuximab. So I'm coming back and treating her with a CD38 targeting antibody regimen in combination with pomalidomide 6 years after she received daratumumab, and she's had a beautiful response.
And when you think about patients like that, are you thinking that in some way ESA is hitting something that Dara doesn't hit, or it's just more what you were saying, that they sort of grow back their BCMA?
I think I could have potentially treated her with daratumumab, but she hadn't had isatuximab. I thought it was worth a try. And I think, to your point, I think it more has to do with the occupancy of the available receptor.
I don't know if you ever heard of Ross Camage in lung cancer from the University of Colorado, but he has this idea of the time capsule, that you put patients in like a time capsule by putting them on a trial and like moving them forward long enough to get a therapy that wasn't available when you first started. And like they go from trial to trial. It sounds like your patient kind of fits into that. Maybe she hasn't had a bispecific yet, right?
She hasn't had a bispecific. When she relapsed, teclistamab wasn't available. And the other thing is, she lives, she'd be commuting 4 hours to get to Boston. And her local community oncologist doesn't yet have teclistamab. So it really wasn't an option for her yet. So we chose what she could receive closer to home.
Interesting. All right, please continue.
So I thought this study was fascinating. This was a correlative study. It was Dr. Cortez Selva. It was a correlative study that was looking at a variety of different correlatives from patients who were treated in the Majestic 1 study, which we've alluded to before. This was a trial that led to the approval of teclistamab, showing a 63% overall response rate. And what's so interesting here is that you can see that the response, clinical response, was associated, as they say here, with a higher frequency and number of peripheral T cells at baseline. You can see on the left, this is the frequency of T cells, and on the right two, or the middle and the right panels, these are the absolute number of CD3 and CD8 T cells. And there's statistically significant differences in these T cell populations among responders versus non-responders. Interestingly, there was a higher frequency of regulatory T cells in non-responders than responders. But to me, being a clinician and clinical researcher, I think this is going to be fascinating to watch, because obviously in engaging T cells, as we do with bispecific antibody therapy, it's going to be, I think, very important to be mindful of what the current state of a patient's T cell population is. I can't really foretell how this will ultimately be incorporated into clinical practice. But to me, it really speaks to what we've talked a little bit about today, which is sequencing treatment. Because if you follow a very T-cell suppressive therapy with a T-cell engager or T-cell redirector, it's not to say that it won't work, but the chances of its success may be significantly less, depending on what the T cell population looks like, as this populations look like, as this data would suggest. So I think this is really interesting data. It'll be neat to keep an eye on this in the coming years, and how we may incorporate some of this understanding into our clinical practice. And as interesting, clinical response was independent of baseline tumor BCMA expression, which likewise isn't so much of a surprise. I think in our development of IDACEL, similar conclusions were drawn, but it's, I think, important in the context of such an active agent like teclistamab to bear that in mind too, that bone marrow expression of BCMA does not predict response. This was an interesting study from Dr. Searle and colleagues. This is the Majestic 2 trial. So this is one of the first reports of a combination regimen of bispecific antibody. And as you can see here, this is a very potentially potent immune treatment with three immune drugs, teclistamab, daratumumab, and lenalidomide. And they were using this in this trial in an earlier line of treatment. So this was 1 to 3 prior lines of therapy. You can see that to date, 31 patients have been treated. There were two different cohorts, one at a step-up dose of 0.72, one at a step-up dose of TEC 1.5. That's what's shown here. And this is a waterfall plot, which I thought was, you know, a bit more interesting to show with regard to this study, to see how responses evolved over time. And you can see that the majority of these patients are still in treatment and responses are deepening. It's still early, but that's the impression that I get in looking at this data. So there were two non-responders. These were probably very high-risk patients, and a patient death as well. Because this is such a immunologically active treatment, I think, you know, we need to keep a close eye on toxicities. And of course, that's the purpose of this particular study. And I think particularly with regard to infection, that's important. That's why I wanted to show this data. So you can see that, you know, 90% of patients had an infection, and nearly 40% of those were grade 3-4. There were also, you know, a number of patients who developed COVID, including grade 3 COVID, and nearly 16% of patients had a grade 3-4 pneumonia. As you can see on the right, there were two fatal AEs, and both of them were infection-related out of, you know, 32 patients. So when we've been faced with this challenge in our field in the past, I think we've been able to offer patients appropriate supportive care that enables them to derive the benefits of the treatment while minimizing as much as possible the risks. And I think in this context, the antimicrobial prophylaxis would be crucial. And I think we'd, you know, also want to think about implementing usage of intravenous immune globulin on a monthly basis, which is something that we frequently do, as you know, following CAR T therapy when patients are so heavily hypogammaglobulinemic, and it might, you know, well be something that we could employ in a combination regimen of this nature.
So, you know, of course, I know that lymphoma is not the same as myeloma, but in terms of bispecifics, one issue that sort of goes across both is who's going to give these bispecifics, and particularly can general medical oncologists in community-based practice give these agents. And, you know, we've been hearing particularly about, you know, the bispecifics in terms of CRS that, you know, it's pretty doable. You know, not, you know, I don't know how many, if you need to have tocilizumab available and whether they usually do. But I'm wondering if the infection issue is going to actually maybe be something a little more tricky to deal with for them. It's so hard to get a feel for it, but I'm kind of getting the feeling that, you know, you always hear about, you know, secondary infections, but and it's so hard to compare, but I kind of get the feeling that it's a bigger issue with bispecifics than maybe anything in myeloma before, but you tell me.
I agree. I think it's a very important toxicity. That's why I wanted to highlight it in this discussion. It's something we can manage, I think, fortunately. A lot of patient education goes into that too, right? I think that's such an important piece of this, is to develop that partnership with patients. And I think, you know, with the approaches that the FDA has endorsed for use of bispecifics in myeloma, where the first cycle of treatment, and when I say bispecifics, plural, I should say teclistamab, where the first cycle of treatment is given in the inpatient setting is very helpful. It may be that over time we develop enough experience and assurance that we could move to a very closely monitored outpatient administration of bispecifics in the same way that many centers perform autologous transplant in the outpatient setting. But it needs to move at the appropriate pace, because you're right. There is a vulnerability here, in that, especially in that first cycle of treatment with regard to the cytokine release, low rates of neurotoxicity, but that needs to be borne in mind. And I think long term, especially, you know, as we begin to use the bispecifics and combinations, you know, that infection risk needs to be very closely managed.
In terms of the first cycle, in terms of CRS, how much of a problem is it? You know, I know, of course, in the beginning, people want to be conservative, but, you know, how often does it really turn out the patient needed to be in the hospital? I get the feeling with CAR-T that it's not rare for that to happen, but what about bispecifics?
With bispecifics, the rates of CRS in most of the trials ranges from around 60 to 80 or 85%, but the rate of grade 3 or grade 4 CRS is, you know, certainly under 10%, and I think in many of the studies it's under 5%. So it's an important consideration, but you're right. I think eventually, at least as it relates to CRS, we may get to the point where we can administer these in the outpatient setting. But in doing so, there will clearly be a need to implement or to have the appropriate infrastructure in the at the clinical centers to closely monitor these patients. It's not one where you can just, you know, sort of treat the patient and let them go home. I think if they're going to be treated at a tertiary care center with a bispecific in cycle one, you'd still want them to be within a short distance of the center so they could receive the care they need if there was an urgent issue that arose.
Yeah, I hear people talking about maybe they'll evolve to a situation where the first cycles given by tertiary center, and then the patient's doing well, send them back to the community. I don't know if that's going to happen. In terms of secondary infection, you kind of alluded to the fact, well, we have things to prevent this, but do they really work? Because, I mean, I assume they were used in the trials when you still had COVID and other problems. So when you use, you know, perfect prophylaxis, how often do you have a significant infection anyhow?
That's a great point you make. You know, these trials were conducted in the middle of a pandemic, right? I mean, and we were still getting our head around how do we manage COVID. And I think we're much better at that than we were. And of course, the vaccinations have helped tremendously. So I think the COVID risk here, while still real and apparent, is one that we're more able now to effectively manage than before. And there's really a paucity of data on how these preventive approaches work, but I can say that in, you know, my own experience in clinical practice, they work quite well. You know, I think in the multiple myeloma field, the initial phase one experience with bortezomib highlighted this fairly interesting observation that, you know, patients who get proteasome inhibitor therapy are at high risk for herpes zoster reactivation, 15%. And, you know, it's somewhat unique to that mechanism of action. And we implemented standard approach to prevention of zoster reactivation. And with appropriate prophylaxis, it's rare to see it. I think in this case, obviously, it's a more immune suppressive treatment, and we need presumably to do more. So the standard would be a antiviral PJP prevention, as well as potentially use of IVIG. I know that in the use of venetoclax in myeloma, we don't have an FDA label for that, but it's a drug that's effective in patients who have the 1114 translocation. But there was, you know, significant safety data from the initial phase three comparison of venetoclax, bortezomib, dex versus bortezomib and dex. And what came out of that after a lot of dialogue and discussion between FDA, manufacturer, and academic centers was you need to employ antibacterial prophylaxis. We're not there with the bispecifics, but I think we're going to be informed by data like this in terms of our practices around supportive care.
Incidentally, in that trial with the venetoclax, where, you know, you saw the non-1114, they did worse, they had worse mortality. Was that related to infection?
It may well have been. It may well have been. And they, you know, of course, they aren't deriving the benefit. We know.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they're good.
Unequivocally, they're not gaining the benefit, and they're more immunosuppressed from having received venetoclax and BCL2 targeting treatment.
Yeah, I never thought about that. And I don't remember whether they broke that out, but it would make sense, actually.
Yeah.
Okay, please continue.
So the next study was presented by Dr. Bayless, and this is looking at elranatinib, which is another BCMA-targeting T-cell redirector or bispecific antibody. And this was encouraging to see that this agent is, like teclistamab, associated with a very high level of overall response at 61% in the same patient population, which is patients who, by and large, were penta-refractory. And as you can see, not only do we have a 61% overall response rate, but nearly 30% of patients get into a complete response and 55% into a VGPR. MRD negativity or MRD status was evaluated in this study. And of those who were evaluable, 90% of patients achieved MRD negativity. And when they talk about evaluable for MRD negativity in the myeloma field, they're typically talking about patients who have achieved a VGPR. Less than a VGPR, we wouldn't be doing MRD analysis. But if you reach level of VGPR, MRD analysis is typically performed, and a 90% rate of MRD negativity. So very impressive data. Like teclistamab, elranatinib is administered once weekly, and like teclistamab, there's a step up in week one of cycle one, and it'll be interesting to see the further development of elranatinib. This is a waterfall plot looking at these responses. So you can see here, 75 patients treated to date, and it's quite encouraging to see that the vast majority of these patients are still on treatment. And you know, we don't have longer term follow up, of course, as yet, but this data would suggest that, you know, these responses are durable. So, as I, you know, frequently tell patients, you know, who are enrolling in treatment of with teclistamab, there's more coming. This isn't the only one, and we've got, you know, more agents coming down the pipeline. Speaking of which, this is the data on talquetamab. So, Dr. Chari has led these efforts with many other investigators, published this data right around the time of ASH in New England Journal of Medicine in 2022. And this is two different cohorts of patients, one of whom received a 0.4 milligram dose weekly and the other a 0.8 milligram per kilogram dose every other week. And, you know, the response data is similar in the two arms, is 73-74% overall response rate with, you know, nearly 60% VGPR. And looking on the right side, you look, well, what have these patients had before? 72% of them were triple class refractory. So refractory to IMiD, refractory to proteasome inhibitor, refractory to a CD38 targeting therapy. And 71% of them were penta-refractory, so refractory to both IMiDs and refractory to two proteasome inhibitors. And yet, you know, the responses were maintained. So this is really, really impressive data. And of course, it's one of several drugs with non-BCMA targets. That's what's, you know, really, really exciting about this. This is a molecule that targets an epitope called GPRC5D, a G protein coupled receptor that's highly expressed on plasma cells and limited expression in other cells, and looks like a very, very promising target. This is interesting. This is looking at patients who receive teclistamab who had had prior T-cell redirection therapy. If we go down the little way on those bullets there on the left, median prior lines of therapy was 6. 70% had had prior CAR T, and 35% had had prior bispecific, and 3 patients had had both. And then you also had a small number of patients who had already had belantamab mafodotin. So, you know, to have a 63% response rate in this patient population is quite impressive and bodes well for the future of our field and for our patients. Because, you know, for those penta-refractory patients, BCMA targeting therapy is clearly their best option. But what about after BCMA targeting therapy? Well, if all continues to go well with the development of talquetamab and several other agents, both bispecific and otherwise, we're going to have options for those patients as well. I did want to include a little bit of information here that Dr. Chari presented on the neurotoxicity, the immune effector cell associated neurotoxicity, because these rates stuck out at me a little bit. You see here in both arms, you had a 10% rate of the neurotoxicity. So not super high, but notable, and something that we would certainly be counseling patients on and very closely monitoring them. The time of onset is always interesting. In both arms is 2 to 3 days. And the duration was short, you know, presumably with patients getting the effective therapies that they needed in the inpatient setting. Most of the patients, you know, recovered from these neurological events, although you can see a small number who did not. There on the left side, not recovered, not resolved. You had 2 in the 0.4 mg per kg arm, and you had 2 in the 0.8 mg per kg arm. So, and most of these patients, as you can see, had concurrent CRS along with the neurotoxicity. So, this is overall very, very impressive data for talquetamab. I thought this was a really interesting study as well. This was from Suzanne Trudell and colleagues who have been involved in the development of cevostamab, which is a FCRH5 targeting bispecific antibody. I've been involved in these efforts with this particular study group, though my team at Dana-Farber wasn't directly involved in this study. We didn't enroll patients to this particular cohort of the trial, but I was very interested to see this data. So as we've talked about today, the CRS is a common side effect and what, you know, requires these patients, at least in the development of the drugs and the clinical trials, to be hospitalized during cycle 1 for monitoring and management. And tocilizumab is an anti-IL-6 treatment along with dexamethasone are the standard treatments that we employ for patients with higher grade CRS. So in this study, the investigators asked the interesting question, well, what if we give tocilizumab not in response to CRS, but give it preemptively before giving the bispecific antibody? And that's exactly what they did. And then this wasn't a randomized analysis a treatment. They basically did a cohort analysis. They treated a certain number of patients this manner and then looked back historically at patients who had already been treated with the exact same regimen, step-up dosing of cevostamab and final dosing, and looked at outcomes. And this is what they found, there on the right, you've got the patients who received tocilizumab before receiving cevostamab. And on the left, you've got the patients who, you know, could have gotten toci, but not until they develop CRS. So they call them the non-toci patients. And you know, clearly those patients who got toci had a much lower rate of CRS and a much lower rate of a CRS overall. So this was interesting. It would then beg the question, did this interfere with or impact response, again, recognizing this wasn't a randomized comparison, but based on this analysis of two different cohorts of patients treated in the trial, you can see that it did not. Patients who received toci in this manner had a 54% response rate, and those that did not had a 37% response rate. On the whole, for this study as a whole, I can say that the overall response rate with cevostamab has been right around 55%. So this is another really, I think, promising drug in the field targeting a non-BCMA epitope, the FCRH5, that would be an option for patients who progress after BCMA-targeted therapy.
So I don't know if this is likely a play of chance or not, but do you think there's a higher response rate? And if there were, what would be the reason?
Yeah, I think that the numbers are too small. So it's 43 versus 31 patients. It's just not enough to say. And of course, right. You don't know about patient characteristics here. But I think it's reassuring to see that there was no major compromise or detriment in this context with the administration of a preemptive dose of tocilizumab.
No, it's really interesting. As long as we're talking about it, I sort of was caught off guard when you showed the ICANS stuff. I sort of thought bispecifics don't cause that.
Well, I think the experience with teclistamab is what we have thus far in standard of care practice. And in my experience treating patients in standard of care practice, the ICANS is somewhat uncommon with teclistamab. And that's precisely why I wanted to show it with teclistamab, because of course each of these are unique agents, and the GPRC5D it's a unique epitope, and that's why it's obviously pivotal to monitor the unique toxicity of these agents.
Interesting. Please continue.
So Dr. Richardson presented an update on the work with mezigdomide, which is a cereblon E ligase targeting compound that is sort of like lenalidomide or pomalidomide, but really amped up in terms of its anti-tumor effects and immunological effects. So very closely related in terms of mechanism of action to lenalidomide and pomalidomide, but more potent. So these drugs, mezigdomide and iberdomide, I think are very exciting as well in terms of the level of response that we're seeing. And Dr. Richardson presented an update on the experience with mezigdomide from the expansion cohort of this particular study. And as you can see here, in 101 patients treated, you had an overall response rate of 41%. And I would, go back to, some of the previous trials in relapsed and refractory myeloma. And on the whole, for a doublet like mezigdomide and dex to lead to an overall response rate of 40% with an all-oral regimen, this is quite promising as well. In terms of toxicity, I just wanted to point out that, the agent is quite marrow suppressive, and there were, fairly high rates of bone marrow suppression, as you can see here. Grade 3 and grade 4 neutropenia occurred quite frequently, and grade 3 and grade 4 thrombocytopenia were notable as well. And I think because of the count suppression, the immunosuppression, this is another agent where, you just have to be mindful of potential risk for infection. As you can see, all grade pneumonia was 22%. Grade 3 was 13%. So I think that's important to bear in mind with this compound as well.
I feel like I've been hearing about these agents for so long. Like, what kind of data is it going to take to get approved?
I can't say with certainty. I haven't been involved in the development of this drug, but I think there's going to be interest in phase 3 data for sure. And that may be, what we're waiting on. I suspect, Neil, that these drugs are probably 2 or 3 years away, at least mezigdomide, 2 or 3 years away from approval. But, I could be wrong.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Laubach, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.